Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. On May 30, 1868, the nation celebrated its first Memorial Day. The day was set aside to honor those soldiers who died defending the Union in the American Civil War. But it has since become a day on which we recall the ultimate sacrifice paid by all American soldiers in all of the nation's wars. In a moment, we'll take a look at the Vietnam War, which claimed the lives of more than 50,000 American soldiers. But before we do that, let's take a look at an important event that occurred this week in history. During this week, in 1790, Rhode Island became the 13th and last original colony to ratify the United States Constitution. When the Constitutional Convention completed its work during the summer of 1787, it sent its proposed new constitution to the American Congress, then meeting in New York City. The Congress sent it to the states, where it would have to be ratified by at least 9 of the 13 states in order to be implemented. By the end of July 1788, 10 states had agreed to the new governmental framework, and the nation proceeded to elect a new Congress and a new president. When George Washington took office in March 1789, however, two states remained out of the Union. North Carolina, which did not ratify the U.S. Constitution until November 21, 1789, and Rhode Island, that signed on May 29, 1790. Turning to an item of historical interest in the news, 55 years after an atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima during World War II, the bombardier who dropped the destructive weapon has died. Colonel Thomas Farabee, retired from the Air Force since 1970, passed away recently after living more than half a century with the label of being the man who deployed the world's first nuclear weapon, one of only two nuclear weapons ever used in war. The bomb dropped from the now-famous B-29 in Nova Gay is reported to have left more than 100,000 Japanese dead. During this season, 75 years ago, one of the most devastating tornadoes in U.S. history, averaging winds of 300 miles per hour, ripped across a three-state region in the Midwest, claiming almost 7,000 lives and leaving millions of dollars of property damage in its wake. Recently, at the National Weather Service's Storm Prediction Center in Norman, Oklahoma, meteorologists commemorated the 75th anniversary of this storm as leading to the development of the nation's first early warning system that today allows forecasters to provide early tornado warnings to Americans across the country. In the spring of 1925, no such system existed. You're listening to Talking History. In recognition of Memorial Day, we've chosen to re-examine the Vietnam War, a war that not only led to the deaths of thousands of American soldiers, but also remains one of the most divisive events in American history. Here to help us take another look at the Vietnam War is Talking History's Dennis Mihalik.
Thank you, Brian. Memorial Day honors Americans who died in battle. 25 years ago this spring, after suffering the death of over 50,000 soldiers, the United States withdrew from Vietnam. Here to put the Vietnam War into historical perspective is Professor Andrew Rotter, Chairman of the History Department at Colgate University and the editor of Light at the End of the Tunnel, a Vietnam War anthology published by Scholarly Resources. Welcome, Professor Rotter.
Thank you, Dennis. Nice to be here.
Let's start with the basics. Why did Vietnam become a battleground?
Well, in some sense, Vietnam has always been a battleground, for a long time anyway. The Chinese were very interested in Vietnam. In fact, Vietnam's recorded history begins in roughly 200 B.C. with a first Chinese invasion of Vietnam. And really for centuries, the Chinese dominated Vietnam culturally. The Vietnamese resisted politically. But the Vietnamese have a powerful sense that their nation has always been fought over by greater powers. This was, of course, enhanced in the 19th century when the French arrived. The French slowly divided Vietnam and extended virtual or actual control over the entire place. The French were the ones who gave the area the name Indochina, which includes Vietnam, along with Laos and Cambodia, neighboring states. The French believed it was the intersection between Indian and Chinese culture. Again, the Vietnamese resisted, often strenuously, against the French efforts to keep them conquered. With the onset of the Second World War in Asia, the Japanese arrived in the region, in Southeast Asia. The Japanese were deeply interested in the area, although, interestingly, not so much in Vietnam itself, which wasn't as rich in natural resources as certain other states in the area. British Malaya, for example, the Dutch East Indies, now known as Indonesia, had a lot of oil that the Japanese needed for the war machine. So for a time, the Japanese allowed the collaborationist French government in Vietnam to remain in place there and essentially ruled through the French. That ended in early 1945 when the Japanese overthrew the French, imprisoned most of them, and took over the rule of Vietnam for themselves. Now, the Japanese, of course, were defeated with the dual atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, surrendered in August of 1945. And at that point, the Vietnamese people, at least a good number of the Vietnamese people, in particular an organization known as the Viet Minh, led by Ho Chi Minh, decided that the moment had come at last for a declaration of Vietnamese independence. The French, they thought, were off the scene. The Japanese had disgraced them, had embarrassed them. There was no reason to think that the French would come back, at least as far as the Vietnamese were concerned. So in early September 1945, Ho Chi Minh declared independence for the state of Vietnam, and he used some of the language from the American Declaration of Independence, which he had, by the way, cross-checked with agents of the Office of Strategic Services, the OSS, the U.S. intelligence agency then operating in northern Vietnam. It wasn't to be, however. The French were interested in coming back, not least because they felt humiliated by their nation's capitulation, ready capitulation to Nazi Germany in 1940. The French believed that in order to become a great power, France needed to regain its colonies, even though this was a period in which nations were divesting themselves, sometimes rather reluctantly, of colonial possessions. The French wanted to repossess Vietnam, and this was a terrible shock to the Vietnamese. Negotiations followed. The Vietnamese angled for the French at least to give them some promise of future independence, but the French were unwilling to do that. And then finally, in late 1946, war broke out between the Vietnamese, again led by the Viet Minh and Ho Chi Minh, and the French, and this would become known as the First Indochina War. And it was after that that the Americans became more interested in the place.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, why did the United States become involved there?
Well, the Americans really had no love for the French experiment in colonialism. The Americans like to think of themselves as people who did not support colonialism. They blinked at their own transgressions of that sort, especially in the Philippines. But after all, the Philippines were given their independence in 1946. So the United States didn't do that kind of thing. France was behaving in a rather atavistic way, an old-fashioned way, to try to maintain its colony. So there was a good deal of vexation with the French. However, that was overcome by growing American fears of the Soviet Union and the Communist bloc. This is the onset, of course, of the Cold War. If it was likely, and it seemed likely, that the Viet Minh, and Ho Chi Minh in particular, were agents of world communism, and this indeed is how American policymakers construed it, then it made sense to support the French as the lesser of two evils, to try and block the expansion of communism into Southeast Asia. Moreover, one could argue, it seems to me, that the Vietnam War began in Europe because the Americans believed that the problems of Europe required solution before any independence could come to at least the Vietnamese people. France was a nation essential to American plans to try to block the expansion, the perceived expansion, of the Soviet Union. There had to be a kind of military presence left in Western Europe. Germany, at least at the time, seemed to be no good. Germany, of course, was a defeated nation, and the idea of reviving a powerful Germany to offset Soviet power didn't become current, at least for several more years. So it had to be the French. The Americans decided that it would be wrong and self-defeating to weaken the French by forcing them out of Southeast Asia. if it was essential for the French to remain a power in Western Europe. Mm-hmm. And this combined with a number of other factors, it wasn't just the French who had an interest in Southeast Asia. The British had a colony, British Malaya. Well, Britain freed India and Pakistan and Burma, gave those nations their independence in the post-war period. British Malaya was not on the list of nations to be liberated, and it so happened that British Malaya produced a good deal of rubber and tin, both of which commodities were important to the United States economy, or had been, especially before the Second World War. The British pressed the Americans to buy more Malayan rubber and tin in order to try and restore the British economy. If somehow the Americans would buy Malayan rubber and tin, then the Malayans could ship dollars that they'd gotten from the Americans back to London, and the British could use those dollars to pay for necessary American imports. So the British had an interest in maintaining access to Southeast Asia. So too did the Japanese. The Americans, as you know, were in charge of the occupation of Japan following the Second World War, and sought to revive Japan economically. Certainly the Japanese couldn't be allowed to embark on military adventures, as they had done prior to 1945. But in order for the Japanese economy to recover from the devastation of the war, the Japanese needed trade. They needed markets, and they needed natural resources. Where better to get those markets and natural resources than the nations of Southeast Asia? China was no longer an option. China was falling to the communists by the late 1940s. So the revival of the Japanese economy, as the British economy, was tied, the Americans believed, to the protection of Southeast Asia from communism. So in a very almost incongruous way, America's Cold War interests came together, intersected in Southeast Asia. And this was connected to an American belief that if you lost Vietnam, the communism, even part of Vietnam, the communism, ultimately all of Indochina, and potentially all of Southeast Asia would fall to communism. This is a belief in the domino theory. If one nation goes, the other nations will topple behind the first nation, falling just like upright dominoes. In order to prevent that from happening then, the administration of Harry S. Truman in 1950 gave a relatively small amount of economic and military aid to the French-sponsored government in Vietnam, tried to shore that government up to be strong enough to prevent the influx of communism into the area. So I would date the first U.S. involvement in Vietnam to that very kind of inconspicuous decision that was made by Truman in the spring of 1950, before the Korean War. I would say that that decision meant that the United States was involved in Vietnam, not for all time, not for permanently, but at least this was a first step, a tangible first step, as the Pentagon Papers later called it, mm-hmm. in the direction of deeper involvement.
Well, then, when and why did the United States become involved militarily?
The military involvement, I guess, depends a bit on what you consider military. It was the Truman administration that first sent a few military advisors to Vietnam to try and help create a Vietnamese army under the French. The French got out of Vietnam following a disastrous military defeat at a place called Dien Bien Phu in the northwestern part of Vietnam in 1954. They were badly beaten by the Viet Minh there, and the following year, 1955, the French decided that there simply wasn't any future for them in Vietnam, and they did get out. What had happened in the meantime was that a convention had come together at Geneva. Strenuous negotiations had produced a situation in which Vietnam was divided into northern and southern entities at the 17th parallel. This was an artificial solution, the Vietnamese believed. Vietnam was not supposed to be a divided nation, but in order to bring about the disengagement of forces following Dien Bien Phu, this division, this artificial division, took place with the promise that Vietnam would be reunited 2 years later in 1956 through national elections. The Americans decided that these elections were very likely to produce a communist government in all of Vietnam, and the then Dwight Eisenhower administration determined that that would not be a good thing. He sent more military advisors to support the now southern Vietnamese government. The CIA, the Central Intelligence Agency, was also put into the field by Eisenhower. This is a typical sort of Eisenhower move. The CIA conducted a number of dirty tricks against the northern Vietnamese by pouring sugar into the gas tanks of Vietnamese trucks and spreading fake leaflets and things like that. But still not a shooting war yet, still on the order of military advising. John Kennedy upped the ante in early 1961. He sent in more advisors. He sent in the Green Berets, who were also there to train the South Vietnamese how to fight, but the Green Berets were armed, and they fired back when they were fired upon. The actual military involvement of the United States, that is, the introduction of combat troops, came only in March of 1965. It was a decision made by President Lyndon Johnson to insert American forces, Marines, 3,500 of them, came ashore at Da Nang on the east coast of Vietnam. And that was the beginning of formal American military involvement. But Johnson saw himself as simply continuing a policy of commitment that had really been in place since Truman, and certainly through Eisenhower and Kennedy. Each president upped the ante.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, by the peak of the Vietnam War, the United States had almost 500,000 troops on the ground there.
Yes.
There's always this perception of how could this backward, quote-unquote, little country withstand all of that American power and technology?
Mm-hmm. Well, a number of reasons. For one thing, let it be said that the Vietnamese did take a terrible beating. And even today, I think the Vietnamese are coming to terms with how dreadful a war it was. There was an awful lot of kind of heroic rhetoric that came out during the war, a lot of defiance. We will never be defeated by the Americans. And, of course, as it turned out, they were not defeated. But there's a striking thing. I was in Vietnam in May of 1998 with a couple of colleagues. And we were in Hanoi and walking down the streets of Hanoi, which is now a vibrant city in a way we hardly expected it to be. But we quickly noticed that there was a relative absence of men aged roughly 45 to 60. It's as if a whole generation of Vietnamese men was lost to the Vietnam War. So one answer is the Vietnamese withstood it with their teeth gritted, and they sustained tremendous losses. But there was something else. The Vietnamese, and the Americans, I think, recognized this early on, did not live in a highly developed, highly concentrated industrial society. This was still largely an agrarian country where most people lived in small rural villages. The industrial production that existed could be rather quickly decentralized. And when the United States started bombing Vietnam, North Vietnam, this too came in the early part of 1965, the Vietnamese were able further to decentralize their economy so that it was difficult for the Americans to find substantial targets. That was a problem, too. And finally, I think it has to be said that the Vietnamese just had a tremendous commitment to hang on and win, even against the most powerful military on Earth. They were committed to getting the Americans out of their country. They were committed, those who fought against the Americans, to the overthrow of what they considered to be the illegitimate government of South Vietnam. So however many losses they sustained, they stayed with the task. They found ways to continue. It was quite horrible, but they managed to do it because they felt strongly committed to an independent Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. In the minute that we have left, do you think there are important lessons to be learned from the Vietnam War?
Yes. I think much depends on where you are in society. I think that probably would determine your answer to the question. I think the military has learned from Vietnam that what you want to do if you're going to fight a war is get the complete commitment of politicians and the American people, and don't fight without certainty of great military predominance. You don't go in halfway. I think it's a bit of military myth-making to say that the hands of the military were tied. This has become a sort of conservative mantra about the Vietnam War. We lost because the military wasn't allowed to do all it could do. There were certain things, I suppose, the military could have done, but there were also restrictions and limits on what the military could do inherently. And an awful lot of bombs were dropped on a very small country, so I'm not sure the military was much held back. But the military believes that it must at least have full-scale civilian support before going into a fight like this. Politicians, I think, have probably learned a similar sort of lesson. You move gingerly into foreign interventions unless you have strong popular support. And I think all of us can learn that it's important to understand what it is the United States is fighting for. Well, why is the U.S. intervening in a foreign place? Can we believe what we're being told by politicians? Certainly a kind of credibility gap has grown up and continues to exist. I think the American people are skeptical, as they weren't before the Vietnam War, about what they're being told by the government and to a certain extent by the press. I think getting allies for foreign interventions is something that presidents now seek to do, and we've seen this. George Bush, I think, did this very effectively at the time of the Gulf War. Bill Clinton, a bit less effectively at the time of the intervention last year in the Balkans. And finally, I think people need to understand the limits of military power. There are certain things you simply cannot do with force, and that, too, I think, is a legacy of the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. That's all the time we have. I want to thank our guests, Professor Andrew Rotter, the editor of Light at the End of the Tunnel, a Vietnam War anthology published by Scholarly Resources.
Continuing on the subject of Vietnam War and Memorial Day, we've asked a conscientious objector who had refused to fight in the Vietnam War what Memorial Day means to him. He's Joe Volk, Executive Secretary of the Friends Committee on National Legislation.
Even though I'm a conscientious objector to war, Memorial Day has a special meaning for me. I think about the 110 million people killed by war since 1900, more than 50% of them just innocent civilians. Of course, I think about my uncles for whom I was named, Earl and Joseph. They fought in World War II. I always wanted to be like them. But mostly on Memorial Day, I think about the day I decided not to participate in war. When my turn came to be like my uncles, I thought that defending our freedoms called for the same courage and patriotism they had exercised, but for very different action. In light of the Nuremberg Principles established by our country after World War II, I thought duty called for me to refuse to fight an illegal and unjust war in Vietnam. I thought citizen soldiers like me not only had a right, but a responsibility to exercise our consciences and take the consequences no matter what. That's being patriotic, even or especially when our leaders disagree. I returned my teaching deferments to my draft board in Wilmington, Ohio, refused an offer of conscientious objector status, gave up my junior high school teaching job, and obeyed the draft. Basic combat training that summer at Fort Jackson, South Carolina, was hot and humid. I held teach-ins about the Vietnam War in the barracks. Well before I got the order to go to Vietnam, bayonet training convinced me that no wars could be just. The drill instructors yelled at us, "What's the spirit of the bayonet?" We learned to yell back at them, "To kill!" Then they yelled, "What does that make you?" We teenagers yelled in response through our tears, "Killers! Yap! Kill!" And we thrust our rifles at each other. When our parents and loved ones asked that night on the payphones how things were going, we lied. "Fine, it's okay." But we had cried because we knew we were destroying the very thing we wanted to protect by going to war, our civilized selves. The next day at bayonet practice, I took off my combat gear, handed it and my rifle to my drill sergeant and said, "I quit." And I did. It's a long story, but a year later I did refuse to go with my unit to Vietnam and was convicted in a court-martial. The charge was AWOL, absent without leave. What does a conscientious objector think about on Memorial Day? I think about Albert Schweitzer's appeal to us all to exercise a reverence for life, and about that day I refused to participate in war. That was the same day I decided the best way to memorialize all those who died in past wars will be to spend the life God gave me helping in the big human project of constructing a world without war so that in the future others may enjoy this planet in peace and unafraid.
You've been listening to Joe Volk, Executive Secretary of the Friends Committee on National Legislation. This is Talking History.
There's something happening here. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there telling me.
As I mentioned earlier, Memorial Day grew out of the American Civil War. So for our site of the week, we've decided to call to your attention a Civil War site that you may not have discovered yet. Here to tell you about it is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
The Pamplin Historical Park, once known as the Pamplin Park Civil War Site, preserves the scene of the crucial 1865 battle in which Union forces broke through General Robert E. Lee's defenses near Petersburg, Virginia. The park has refashioned itself since it opened 5 years ago, and one of the biggest changes is the 25,000-square-foot National Museum of the Civil War Soldier. It allows visitors to trace the war's history by following the fate of any of 13 soldiers whose lives are reconstructed from diaries and letters. A section called Trial by Fire uses big-screen videos to recreate the sounds and sights of battle, including the shouting of orders from the commander and floors that shake when cannons are fired. There's also a military encampment with a costumed reenactment and costumed guides for the restored Antebellum House. The Pamplin Historical Park is located 31 miles south of Richmond, Virginia, and is open daily.
And finally, we turn to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions. This week, we alert you to two new exhibits at the National Museum of American History in Washington, D.C. The first is certainly a timely one. It provides a history of the United States Census. Census 2000, Counting America, 1790 to 2000, uses photographs and other objects not only to review the history of this constitutionally mandated population count, but also to provide information on changes in the nation's population discovered with each census over the past 200 years. Census 2000 closes at the end of July. Also at the National Museum until August 13th is This Land is Your Land, an exhibit that revisits the life and legacy of one of America's greatest folk singers, Woody Guthrie. The exhibit explores how Guthrie infused into his music the tragedies and hard times of the common man, which gave his music purpose and sparked a lifelong dedication to social activism. And if you're ready to test your knowledge of American history again in another segment of the Great American History Quiz, tune in to History Channel on June 5th. The quiz master this time will be Chevy Chase, and you can download an answer sheet ahead of time from the History Channel's homepage. That's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our program and that you will join us next week when we'll take a look at the history of women in professional baseball. Until then, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.
I will remember you. Will you remember me? Don't let your love pass you by. Ignore your mind.